This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9 wishes to advise the following program, Hide and Seek, is a show intended for an adult audience. Generally, our discussions are of a sexual nature and may contain coarse language and references to drugs.
Sit back and enjoy the ride, and enjoy the ride, and enjoy the ride, and enjoy, 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 and enjoy the ride.
Now, I want you all there at home to think of the last time you had sex. Whether it was with your regular partner or with some hot random that you'd picked up at the bar, maybe you've met online. Now, ask yourself this question. Did I give consent to having sex? Perhaps more importantly, did they give consent to me to have sex? How was consent exchanged? Was it assumed? Was it implied? Was it clearly defined, or did sex just happen? One woman that's been doing a lot of research into this very tricky subject of consent is Anne Worthington. Anne is a producer on SBS's debating program Insight, and she joins us now on the line. Anne, welcome to Hide and Seek, and welcome to Joy 94.9.
Thank you.
Now, Anne, you have been researching a program that will air on the 4th of August, all around consent. Let's have a little conversation about what you've come up with in your research.
Well, look, the reason why we decided to do the program was as a bit of a water cooler from the debate that kind of raged after the Matthew Johns group sex scandal. You know, suddenly the debate seemed to kind of really divide. The two camps are divided, and you could see that on Facebook between the support Maddie Johns sites and the support Claire sites. And when we kind of went through the comments that were being left, it was about this issue of consent. And, you know, those on the Maddie Johns support side were saying, you know, she consented, she went back to the bedroom, you know, she was up for it. And the ones on Claire were saying, how could you possibly give informed consent when you're a 19-year-old in the room with that many guys and there's a clear power imbalance? So I guess the show just kind of stemmed from that, and we started to kind of have a look into the issue of consent, which legally there's a lot being written, but the actual what it is, how we get it, and how we should be getting it. The research is actually quite slim on it. The slim pickings, there hasn't been a great deal of research into that specific area.
And you've come across laws being currently challenged, I guess, and redefined in states throughout Australia.
Yeah, well, over the past year, the laws have moved to try and be a little bit more progressive. The crime of sexual assault notoriously has very low conviction rates, and something like only 20-30% of all sexual assault cases reach courts if indeed they get reported. So the kind of figures are always really sketchy around it, but looking at the low conviction rates and how fair the kind of system was to alleged rape victims, a lot of states moved to implement changes to the law in regard to the issue of consent, adding new clauses in terms of intoxication. So South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria introduced laws that basically said that a woman or a victim may be nullified from giving consent if they are substantially intoxicated. So they have moved to that degree. Some people think it's gone too far because, you know, with the clause around alcohol, and other people say that it hasn't gone, that, you know, that it's fairer to the person making the complaint. The other one that they introduced was that a woman no longer needs to give a verbal no or physically show a refusal. If either of those things aren't present, it doesn't immediately signify consent. And also that the emphasis in New South Wales in particular, that the defendant has to actually prove how they received consent as opposed to the complainant showing how consent was not given.
So in that case, the onus comes back on to the defendant to actually acknowledge in what way they acknowledged consent. Now, there's a case currently being tried in South Australia, which we won't go into too much detail on, but needless to say, there is a scenario where consent was given by the two parties, but they were very, very drunk at the time. And basically, halfway through the act of sex, one of them passed out. Now, the other continued to engage in sex. It was then deemed to be rape after the fact. Now, this is challenging the courts at the moment, so we still haven't sorted it out, have we?
Yeah, look, and there's a lot of people that would argue that there's no such thing as technical rape. It's clear if a woman's unconscious, it's in the law, she's totally incapable of giving consent. But the judge is obviously confused about it and thinks that, you know, it is of a less kind of crime than, you know, what perhaps a gang rape might be, etc. So they're kind of saying that he's looking at it as a lower, on the lower spectrum, and it kind of brings into what sentence he should give. So there is debate around it at the moment, especially with the intoxicated kind of clause that's in the law. But interestingly, through our research and speaking to people, alcohol does seem to really blur the boundary. A strong argument is why the defendant's not allowed to use the fact that they were intoxicated and you know, not coherent enough to be able to read the signals. So why is it a defence for the complainant and not for them? There's that criticism. And also just dealing with young people, you know, I mean, when alcohol is involved in most of their sexual encounters, and that most sexual encounters do happen non-verbally, how, you know, what could be seen as, you know, could be a misunderstanding, could suddenly become before the legal courts. So there's questions around that area.
There's also scenarios where married couples have challenged the courts, and one party has said that consent to sex hasn't been given in the umbrella of a marriage. Have you looked at that in regards to your program as well?
We did look at that. I mean, it's only about 20 years ago that, you know, society kind of recognised that rape can happen within marriage. One lady who's been very big on this research, and she is a guest of ours, Associate Professor Moira Carmody, she's with the Social Justice and Social Change Research Group at the University of Western Sydney. She's very big in pushing education. She's kind of spent 20 years in this area, looked at it, realised that the law can only go so far because it is such a often he said, she said situation, very little evidence, and, you know, obviously resulting in those low conviction rates. She kind of talks much more about the gendered attitudes that are prevalent, and it's kind of changing these attitudes that society needs to embrace before any kind of real change can be made in this area.
And these are cultural changes, really, aren't they? That are some, in a way, generational, really.
Yeah, they are, although they start, you know, whenever it starts, you know, those gendered ingrained things, I guess they start from a very young age, but they do prevail all the way, even up into the legal system where, you know, it's that kind of onus is on the woman, for example, just say no. When she doesn't say no, then, you know, the fault lays with her, and it's that kind of blame factor that is so prevalent within and amongst sexual assault survivors. Was she encouraging? Was there a degree of, you know, flirting? You know, what was she wearing? All those kind of old stereotypes that feed back into this discussion. But in terms of marriages, just to get back to the question that you asked before, and relationships, Moira's research actually showed that people in relationships are much more open about discussing what they do and don't want in their sex lives, and they tend to express it much more in a verbal way, which is clearer. It's the casual relationships, the one night stands, etc., that people are doing non-verbally, and that's often when alcohol is involved, and that's often when that line between sex and ethical sex and what can become a crime can get crossed.
And your research also uncovered some really interesting information in regards to gay men and lesbians. Can you tell us a little bit about that too?
Yeah, well, that was Moira's research again, and she basically did she conducted a survey with young people, and what she found was that within the gay community, young gay men were much better at setting the boundaries, much clearer, verbally clearer in saying yes or no. Obviously, unwanted and coerced sex and sexual assault does happen, but she said that she found amongst her research that they were much clearer in defining those boundaries. And when she looked at young lesbian women, she found that whilst they were often better at saying no than heterosexual young women. They were still struggling, as were heterosexual young women, on kind of describing and expressing their desires and what they did want out of the sexual encounter.
In being clear in their communications of what they required.
Being clear, yeah.
And it's a fascinating topic that is very open-ended. Your show hasn't been taped yet, has it?
No, it isn't, but we've got some, you know, we've got some great people lined up. We've got a young woman who is unfortunately a victim of another group sex situation, very similar to the one that was on Four Corners with involving football players. And once again, the kind of the ambiguous nature of how she gave or didn't give consent is in her story. And we've also got young men joining us to talk about where they find it difficult. One man in particular is talking very much about his young life in a surfing community and what he witnessed and participated in, which is quite powerful, really.
And chilling in some regards, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of regret and remorse there as well.
I think it's a big wake-up call to us all, really.
Anne
Worthington, thank you very much for joining us on Hide and Seek.
Thank you very much.
The program on SBS is Insight. It will air on August the 4th, Tuesday, August the 4th. And thanks for joining us. Take care.
Thanks very much. Have a good night.
Hide and Seek.
Now, in the shadow of a case currently pending in South Australia, the issue of consent often raises its elusive head. Just when, where, how, and under what circumstances can consent be given, agreed upon, or dare we say it, assumed? Joining us on Hide and Seek to help us navigate this minefield of legalities is Melbourne's very own congenial cop, our favourite boy in blue, the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer for Victoria Police, Sergeant Scott Davis. Sergeant, welcome to Hide and Seek.
What a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Dean.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What were the words you used there? They were very nice.
Our very own congenial.
Very own congenial, yes. That's much nicer than Paul Anthony, who just says the good police.
The good police.
Yes.
Oh, right. As opposed to the bad police.
That's, and that conversation always starts that way. But anyway, yes. Some people like it, some people don't. But I like the congenial. That's very nice.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us at this ridiculous hour of the night, but it allows us to talk freely about things that I guess normally you don't get to hear on here.
Yeah, that's right.
So this sticky situation of consent.
It's an interesting one, isn't it?
It sure is.
And I suppose we should start off by saying that, you know, what we're talking about tonight is not specific to any specific cases.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, anything that we do talk about, I suppose, is put into an advice sphere rather than a defined legality sphere.
Absolutely. And that's very much the state of this show, is that anything that we mention ever on Hide and Seek is about you exploring the matter further and taking on board what we say as information, sometimes education, but it's up to you to explore it further and explore it responsibly. Yep.
So I might talk about legal definitions, but of course, once you get into a court arena, if you know, the worst case scenario, you end
please
up in that.
Please don't quote Sergeant Scott Davis.
Yeah, if you end up in that arena, that's right. It's no longer black and white. There's a whole lot of other things that happen there.
Well, you're quite right there, because it really is a sad state of affairs that we can't make this black and white. But I guess much of law is grey and open to interpretation, and it's only relevant until it's challenged.
And we're talking about people's emotions and interpretations, and unfortunately, as you suggest, that, you know, everyone's interpretation of what might have been negotiated could be different, and that's why it does get to that important point of really understanding what it is that has been negotiated.
So let's bring it back to the state of Victoria.
Yep.
That's where we're at. Has the law got a definition for what we call consent?
It's quite simple what the law states. It talks about a free agreement. And that's it. Within the definition, within the Crimes Act, it talks about free agreement.
So that means equal agreement on both sides.
Correct, yeah. Now, it does talk about some things that would be as examples of things where you would not be able to consent, if you'd like me to give you some of those
ideas.
Yeah,
please.
So we can talk about a situation where somebody submits, so they look like they're consenting, but they're doing it because they've been forced, or there's the fear of force. And that could be to themselves or by somebody else. The person submits for fear of harm to somebody else as well.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about somebody who is being unlawfully detained. So the only way I'm going to get out of this is to consent.
Is to give in. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yep. You've got somebody where they're asleep. And I know you were talking about that with the people from Insight. Unconscious, affected by alcohol or other drugs, and as being unable to then make a free agreement as a result of the drug use or alcohol use. Incapable of understanding the sexual nature of the act, and that might be, say, in relation to, say, an acquired brain injury, or the person has a mental capacity that perhaps doesn't understand the full sexual nature of the act, or that they might be very innocent and they believe that let's say you're talking about oral sex, that they believe that to be something completely different to what the person asking for that believes oral sex to be.
So a misinterpretation of what they thought was going to happen.
Correct.
Right.
That's right. There's also this mistaken understanding about what the sexual nature is, or even the identity of the person. And I know that there was a situation with some sports people where girls had freely consented to have sex with some sports people, one in one room, one in another room at a motel, and then the guys decided to swap, and the girls didn't know that the swap had occurred because it was in the dark. And so they thought they were freely consenting to a particular person, but turns out that it wasn't that person.
And indeed, there's the high-profile sports case, I guess, of a woman who it seemed consented to, well, more than one, but not 12 or whatever it ended up being.
That's
so,
right.
So, you know, at what point in time does that level of consent diminish?
Mm. And that gets back to that conversation that you would have with that person around what they're consenting to.
But it's not always as clear as a conversation, is it?
It's not. And I suppose, I'll give you an example which I was talking about before we came on air in regards to a gentleman who had agreed to anal penetration sex, but only with a condom. And he believed that the condom was removed during the sex act, and as such, that would be considered to be a rape.
So under that definition, I guess the agreement, the free agreement as you refer to it,
yep,
was clearly defined beforehand.
Yes.
But then changed halfway through the act.
Mm.
And so it's at that point of change that the consent automatically is withdrawn.
That's right.
In the eyes of the law.
That's right.
Right.
And that doesn't have to be about saying no or stop.
No. It's in fact, it's the diminishing of the original agreement.
That's right, yeah.
That then withdraws the consent.
Mm.
But consent can also be non-verbal. It can be in body language.
Yep.
It can be hinted at. It can be automatically assumed. I mean, I've hooked up with people online. They've come over to my place. I've welcomed them in the door. The fact that I've said, hello, come on in, probably means I've given consent. Does it mean that they have?
Well, and that's true. It then is that discussion. And as you say, you know, as humans, we don't necessarily discuss every intimate detail of what it is that we're going to go through. But if we're starting to head down the line of a sexual act, then I suppose you need to be, as well as looking for clues that this is the path that they do want to go down, you also need to be looking for clues that that's the path they don't want to go down.
I think that's a very good point, because when we're in the throes of passion, let's call it that, or just got a raging heart on, we don't really think that someone else might not be in the same headspace as we are.
Mm.
And our thoughts can be very clouded in that regard. And if people feel a little disempowered, or if they're not able to speak up, then I guess they sometimes would feel cornered into scenarios that they really don't want to be in.
Yeah, and then that gets us back into that situation we were talking about, where people are not able to make consent. Well, they're feeling fear and force that, oh, I just have to go through with this just to make it end.
And it may be in a peer environment where, you know, there might be more than one person there. They don't want to see or be seen to be the odd person out,
mm,
and participate in an act that they're really not comfortable in. And I guess it's about us recognising those signs that person isn't at ease.
Yeah.
And acknowledging it then.
Yeah, and I suppose you can even think about the pest and, you know, come on, let's do it.
Sure.
No, I really don't want to. Come on. No. Oh, come on, let's just. And then you just get to the point, all right, let's just get this over and done with.
And sex is no different than the school playground in that regard.
How much of a consent is that? And if the person really wanted to push it, then that, you know, then that's that black and white. It's no longer black and white. It requires a whole lot of discussion around the legalities of it all.
Yeah, and I guess with the case in South Australia where somebody had consented to an act, yes, they were drunk, but they were both freely consenting to having sex, but they passed out halfway through the act. What would happen in Victoria if that happened?
I suppose when we look at what's written into the legislation about when you can't consent, and it clearly states you cannot consent when you're asleep.
Right.
So it's... Yeah. At the point when you are aware that the person has fallen asleep, you pretty much have to stop.
I think that's pretty black and white.
It is black and white. But then it also relies on the person who you were having sex with to want to report it. So it's not always necessarily the case of, well, the police become aware of it, we're going to charge. We need a whole range of different things to occur. So it is... black and white. If they're falling asleep, then you have to stop. But then, you know, what did the person consent to beforehand? If I fall asleep, you know, just keep going, all that sort of stuff. And then that's consent. Whereas they're falling asleep, yeah, it's grey.
It sure is. You're listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. We'll be back with Sergeant Scott Davis to talk about this sticky little issue a little further in just a moment.
Hide and Seek.
In the studio with me is Sergeant Scott Davis from the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Office. Now, he's going to debate this rather interesting case. I'm going to throw a spanner in the works, and I mean that both figuratively and literally. There was a case in the UK it happened in 1987, called Operation Spanner. And bear with me whilst I read you this little case history. During a raid in 1987, the police seized a videotape which showed a number of identifiable men engaging in heavy S&M activities, including beatings, general abrasions, and lacerations. Police claim that they immediately started a murder investigation because they were convinced that the men were being killed. This investigation is rumoured to have cost, at the time, some £4 million. Dozens of gay men were interviewed. The police learned that none of the men in the video had been murdered or even suffered serious injury, which required medical attention. However, the police may have well felt that they had been justified in their prosecutions and then went ahead and attempted to jail all 16 gay men participating in these S&M activities. It was called Operation Spanner, and it created a huge international legal precedent. S&M activities are legal or illegal? Sergeant Scott Davis.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Great. Is that the answer you wanted? I'm glad we cleared that up. That's great.
I suppose we have to look at the situation in Victoria, and we do get our legal precedents in a lot of cases from the UK, which is certainly the case.
Are they a direct referral, by the way?
I'm going back to Law 101 at the Police Academy. We were only in there for 20 weeks, so just bear with me. Yes.
As a general rule.
Yeah. As a general rule, there can be precedents that come from the UK. We certainly draw our Westminster system from the UK. So, yes, that's the case. So, when we look at defences to an assault, the police will use the acronym CAMELS. So, we're talking about consent, amicable contest, misadventure or mere accident, execution of the law, lawful correction or chastisement, and self-defence of yourself or property. So those are the...
Right, I'll just get that tattooed on my forehead.
Yep, CAMELS.
Right, CAMELS.
That's the easiest way to remember it.
But so it starts with consent.
It does start with consent. Yep,
right.
That's right. So you can consent to an assault. So if you're talking about S&M, you can consent to S&M. But the legal precedent that you were talking about provides us with case law that talks about the fact that there are times when you cannot consent according to that specific piece of case law. And it talks about, in that term, in the UK, it talks about the term grievous bodily harm. When we translate that into Victorian legislation in the Crimes Act, that would be considered to be injury or serious injury. So we're saying that in Victoria, you cannot consent to an injury or a serious injury. And then within the Crimes Act, they provide some definitions. And so they say injury includes unconsciousness, hysteria, pain, and any substantial impairment of bodily function. And a serious injury would be a combination of injuries, so a combination of those. So those are the includes, but of course there are others.
So is drawing blood from engaging in a flogging considered a serious injury?
It would be considered an injury,
right?
Because it's one incident. Yes. If there was a combination, then it would be a serious injury. So if there were, say, multiple welts, welts and drawing blood, then that would go along the lines of serious injury.
And you can't consent to that.
Can't consent to that. That's right.
Fascinating stuff.
Mm. And it is interesting because that was an interesting case in the UK because the police relied on video evidence that they found in the people's houses.
And those men admitted to it.
They did admit to it. They admitted that they were engaging in that behaviour. They admitted that they had caused injury to the people, but they'd all consented to it.
Indeed. And in fact, it was subsequently found that if they'd kept their mouths shut, even though that there was the videotape, that the police wouldn't have a case.
I don't know about that because the videotape itself would be evidence, and then from that you would be able to see what injuries were occurring. So the judge would have still been in a position, and I think it was multiple judges, would have been in a position to be able to make a decision.
In fact, the case itself was referred to the Law Lords in London, who dismissed the case 3-2, and Lord Templeton in particular declared that, in principle, there is a difference between violence, which is incidental, and violence, which is inflicted for the indulgence of cruelty. The violence of sadomasochistic encounters involves the indulgence of cruelty by sadists and the degradation of victims. Such violence is injurious to the participants and unpredictably dangerous. I am not prepared to invent a defence of consent for the sadomasochistic encounters which breed and glorify cruelty. Society is entitled and bound to protect itself against a cult of violence. Pleasure derived from the infliction of pain is an evil thing. Cruelty is uncivilised. That from the good Lord himself. Now, that then went to the European courts and was tried in international law courts.
Yep.
And they basically said the same thing. They said, look, you know, we need to protect, I guess, the greater good of humanity. And as such, we're throwing it out.
Yeah. So I suppose an important point to note here is that we're talking about its case law, and case law can be changed. It's not enshrined in legislation. It's enshrined through case law, but it's pretty significant case law, having gone to international courts.
Why is it that I can go into a boxing ring and beat the shit out of someone to the point of creating permanent brain damage and not be charged by law?
Because you're talking about the amicable contest side of things, and that both people have gone in, and there's a set of defined rules which have been set up by national bodies around what the defined rules are. And I know you're going to play devil's advocate.
You know how silly that sounds.
I know it
don't
does. And, you know, that's the way that it's set up. There's defined rules around, set up by an international body. They're there in black and white for people to be able to read. But we've already spoken about the fact that even within legislation, it's not necessarily as simple as being black and white.
And in fact, the case of an old boxing title was used as a defence for one of the cases. And again, it was found that just didn't hold up in court.
And there's been situations in even in sport, say football and rugby, where they've looked at people who have assaulted, say, behind play, and what they've said there is that the argument was that, well, if you're playing football, you have to expect that there will be a bit of argy-bargy, and that it's not unreasonable to be expect that you could be punched. And there was some case law that suggested that even within a football match, there will be rough and tumble, but you cannot expect that you will be punched and seriously injured, and people have been charged as a result of that. So even within organised sport and the amicable contest realm, it can be removed and you could still be charged with the assault.
Are there any cases of people being humiliated to the point of, and I guess that's mental abuse, so we're not talking physical harm here, but we're talking people in extreme play of humiliation or degradation where they've mentally found themselves go beyond the realms of what they perhaps had consented to. And in that play, I know that it is important for the dominant person to bring the subordinate back into a state of normality after the event. But if that is not transpired and the person is left harmed mentally by the situation, has there been cases where that has been brought up as not consenting to going to that extreme? And I guess mental rape, is there such a thing as mental rape?
Mental
abuse, I guess.
Probably heading into an area that I don't know a lot about. I'm not aware of any specific case law around that particular area. It then gets back to, and this was an interesting case in the UK because the people there hadn't consented to be involved even in the prosecution. In most instances here, we would rely on the victim being part of the prosecution case, except in family violence incidents, that's different because that's about
the child being a victim. You mean,
or the partner? It can be a male partner or a female partner. In where we're talking about relationship violence, and there's an imbalance in the relationship in the power. The police try to take the power of control away from the offending party. There's lots of power play that go on there. If I get arrested, you'll lose money, we'll lose the house, the kids, all that sort of stuff.
So the police just take over in that situation.
In those instances, what we've done is we've looked at a code of practice for investigation of family violence. The way to break the cycle of violence was for us to take over. So we would not necessarily involve the woman, as it is in most instances, the prosecution. We would rely on other evidence, so whether that's from neighbours, whether that's from our own observations,
physical evidence,
children, all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So that's the way we would operate in a family violence situation. But we're talking about a situation here, if we're talking about S&M play, where in most instances we would have to rely on the other party to be a party of the prosecution.
Sergeant Scott Davis, it has been a very interesting conversation. It has been a difficult one to navigate, but I really thank you for coming in and speaking to us on our Hide and Seek and for opening up the lines of communication around what is a very, very sensitive area.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us.
Hide and Seek.
Sponsored by Circuit Bar. Circuit.com.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.